My name is Gords, also known as MC WizKid. Welcome to Series 1 of the Pod Noodle. Ladies and gentlemen, we are not messing about here on the Pod Noodle. Once again, we bring you the creme de la creme of dance music and entertainment. And I am sat looking at, arguably, one of the creators of a genre, one of the biggest producers of a period that was so exciting for the music that we're going to talk about a bit later on. Also, this guy has worked with some of the biggest artists even outside of his own genre. This guy is an absolute legend. I first got to know him through teaching. Obviously, our paths have crossed several times in the live arena, but now I'm very proud to call him a friend. Ladies and gentlemen, I give to you Mr. Ben Keane, also known as the mighty BK. How you doing, hello, man?
That was a very good intro. Jesus, thank you.
Well, it's nothing but the truth, man. How's your day?
Yeah, good. Thank you very much. Just been pottering in the studio this morning.
Amazing. What are you should I ask? Am I allowed to ask?
I was just looking at signing a 5-single deal with someone. So I've been preparing music for doing all of that kind of stuff, a big European label. Sorry.
Amazing. I mean, I'm going to touch on some of the releases and stuff, but also I'm sort of mindful that being WizKid and whatnot, I get asked the same questions all the time, as I'm sure you do, being BK. So I'm going to try not... Sorry?
What's your favourite record?
Yeah, what's your favourite...
If you were a colour, what colour would you be?
Well, we all know you'd be a rainbow, my friend, but thinking about the times before being the DJ producer that you sort of went on to become. And I want you to sort of cast your mind all the way back to, I assume, being a teenager. How did you kind of discover the whole rave thing? What sort of pulled you towards it? What was that journey like?
Well, it was from school, really, to be honest. So I went to school out in Essex, which is a big place where rave came from, where the Prodigy came from. Where Romford was, where Suburban Bass was. And I had a friend of mine who was a year above me in school, was putting on, while we were at school, I was maybe 15, he was 16, or I was just, you know, just nearly turning 16, probably 15, to be honest. He was putting on raves. He started to put on raves in a venue in Leebridge Road called Wonderland Arena. And in fact, I think one of his very first parties, as if you think back now, I think it was Prodigy, Carl Cox and Shades of Rhythm. Now, if you imagine having to pay for that lineup now, that'd be absolutely crazy. And that's how I got into it. I got into going to those parties and driving around London with him in his car, handing out flyers where you could park anywhere back in those days and run into a record shop or a sort of place and drop off flyers. And yeah, and he had a party. It was called Elevations and Volatile State.
Right.
It was and one of when they eventually split, obviously Elevations continued and became Moondance.
Wow.
And it was he used to do parties with MC Funky back in the day, and we were, you know, kids.
Well, I was going to say, I think Funky went on is now at the helm of Moondance, if I'm not wrong.
I think he's the man that then took it off. And I used to go to those parties at a venue called Leebridge Road, which they were something to do with called Wonderland in Leebridge Road in London. There was Wonderland, there was the Dungeons, there was Labyrinth in Dalston that we used to go to all the time. Our friend Mr. Bunter was playing as a teenage boy, and he had those infamous stairs to nowhere. If you ever went, you'd turn the corner and climb some stairs and just reach a wall. And no matter how many times you went, you'd be stumbling around in the dark, a bit off your tits, and you'd still walk up those stairs and think, where the hell does this go? And then you'd go, all right, yeah, they don't go anywhere.
I remember those days, man. I think my first experience of Labyrinth was a little bit later along the line, and I think Stevie Hyper D was performing there. From memory, the late great Stevie Hyper D, and that's what I took away from me. I was dead nervous to be there, obviously, like you probably were in your first times. But I remember he was absolutely amazing. So obviously you're going on these like early sort of hardcore rave experiences. I mean, were you like a full on raver? What was the vibe, man?
I became a full on raver eventually, until they suggested to me that it wasn't worth me staying on at sixth form. I should go and get a job somewhere, because I wasn't there on a Monday or Tuesday. I was coming back from being in a field somewhere. Yeah. You know, I did the whole biology, telepathy, parking on the side of the M25, leaving your car there, traipsing across a field, you know, to go to raves.
Amazing.
Just crazy, crazy, crazy times, you know, listening to Centreforce, which is still going now, you know, listening to Centreforce radio and things like that, and listening to where you're going to meet up in a car park or meet up at a place called Berwick Manor and then drive from there to a rave that they'd only give the location to, you know, at the last minute.
Amazing.
Good, exciting times with no health and safety, any of that kind of stuff, but really, really, really good times.
Was there like a moment where, obviously, you're sort of immersed in this racing, you've got your crew of friends, you're living the life, you're going to the fields, the illegals, all of that stuff. Was there a moment that you can sort of recall where you sort of stood there and thought, yeah, man, I need to...
Yeah, I think I remember being in Wonderland Arena, the venue we already talked about, seeing, you know, like Prodigy perform live, and thinking, yeah, I want a piece of this. You know, watching the response a DJ gets when he drops a massive record. And you know, yeah, thinking, you know, I want a piece of this. But my brain would tick a little bit more. And I would think, I'd watch all the DJs and stuff getting adulation. And of course, it's, you know, DJing's a massive skill of its own. But I would think, well, hold on a minute. They are playing someone else's record, right? Yeah, obviously it's a skill within itself, but my brain went kind of further than that. And I think, well, how did that record get onto that bit of vinyl? And I'd start thinking, you know, that way forward and be sort of more interested in, at that time, in how it was made, you know, and making music.
So was it like the next steps, obviously, is to start being creative in some way? I mean, obviously it's always been within you, but was it the decks first? Was it getting in the studio? Like, what was the next...
I had my own decks. I had the old Sound Lab belt driven things with the yellow and blue Newmark mixer that everyone had back in the day.
Yeah, man.
I had all that stuff. But then I started to, when I left school, I worked in a record shop for 5 months, you know, not a long time. And while I was working there, I wrote off to recording studios to try and get a job in recording studios. And I put myself on this little course to look. So I learned about MIDI and learned about all the jargon so I could go and give it the spiel at these interviews.
Yeah.
And wrote off to loads of places. Eventually I got an interview at a place that down in Carnaby Street in London called Macasso Music. And they did some record stuff, but mainly music for TV ads and films and stuff like that. And I got a job as a T-boy there. A T-boy Stoke trainee engineer, you know, managed to get the job there. I was 18, something like that, I think.
Wow.
17, 18. And I got the job there and I was a runner. So I used to drop tapes off to all the editing suites and you'd drop tapes off to the editing suites, but you'd also, back in those days, you know, make the pint of Jack Daniels and Coke for an artist that was coming in, or skin up for someone, you know, all those duties as well. But at the same time, you'd be learning the engineer, like the old days, you'd have a big mixing desk.
Yeah.
The engineer would sit there, the main engineer, and go, right, can you plug that reverb into channel one, channel two? And you'd start by doing that, by becoming a tape op, or literally swapping the old 24 tracks around, taking them off, putting a new one in, queuing it up, loading the tape machines, tape opping. And during the course of that, you would learn how to become an engineer yourself, and you learn from people that have been doing it years.
That's amazing. And was there like famous artists passing through at this point as well? I mean,
I did have a few artists come through. Yeah, they, I know Kate Bush had an album thing there, and Suggs was there a few times. Wow. And stuff like that. But it was mainly film stuff and TV stuff, which was a brilliant education, because when you work on film and TV stuff, and especially in that time, they would, an advertising company would come and say, look, we've got permission to use Michael Jackson's badge from the publisher on this commercial, whatever they're trying, making the track up, but we can't use the original recording. So can you duplicate it? So can you copy it and make it sound exactly alike? So by doing that loads and loads of times, you learn that, okay, that's a 909 kick on those sort of records, or that's an 808 hat. And you literally get the ability to listen to a record and go, all right, yeah. That's a 606 hat, 707 snare, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And you learn all this wealth of information by doing that stuff. And one of the guys that was teaching me there was a guy called Toby. He used to go to a club called, there was a gay guy there called Toby. He used to go to a gay club called Heaven on a Friday night, and another club called Trade. And he took me out, and we went out on a night to go and see Heaven and go and see people like Mrs. Woods and Blue Peter and the Sharp Boys DJ back there. Mm. It was all around the time where it was React Records in the UK.
Yeah.
So it was Age of Love, Quench Dreams, Shinny, all those records were the you know.
Yeah.
And we started going clubbing together pretty much every single week. And that's when I discovered the kind of hard house kind of vibe, or it was called techno really in those days, techno or trance even. It wasn't really called hard house. And that's when I discovered DJs like Tony DeVee and all the Trade Lot, who are, you know, some of the originators of that sound. And that's how I discovered it all.
And at this point, you're just kind of going along with a friend and sort of getting to know these people just by
going out club. No, not even getting to know the people in the clubs, just being a clubber. Just going out and dancing and being a clubber for 4 or 5 years, you know, and doing that, just, you know, just. But then eventually what happened is I used to start going back to the studio when it was closed, and I had my own set of keys, and I'd let myself in, because at that time you couldn't have any of your own recording equipment, but only if you were mega rich, you know.
Yeah.
You know, samplers cost thousands and thousands of pounds. You put it into perspective, I think, you know, a sampler in those days, a 1100 or a 3000 Akai, was probably, with decent memory, about $4,000 or $5,000 to buy.
Yeah.
It gave you like 32 seconds of stereo sampling. I've got a doorbell that can play MP3s that cost me $9.99 that has got 10 times the amount of storage data on it than those original samplers had. So I used to go back and use all the equipment, all the big mixing desks, to try and learn and teach myself how to make the music that I loved.
What was your first sort of creation? Obviously, you've got experience. You're already on the job. You're recreating these big songs for TV and film and whatever, and putting your own spin on them. When it came to your personal creation, the first thing that you... Was it like a hardcore record? Was it a techno record? What was the first...
It was a hardcore record. I think it was actually a top 20 hardcore record when I was about 18 and 19. It got signed to MCA.
Wow.
And it was, I did it with the guy who was teaching me to engineer. We decided, because we were going clubbing, we'd make something together. And it was called Tech 2. And they then, because it was a TV advertising company, they managed to get it synced to the Playboy. The Game Boy, sorry, Playboy.
Yeah. That's a different conversation there.
the Game Boy TV ad.
Right. Wow.
It then went on the Game Boy TV ad.
And this is your first thing you've done?
My first release, yeah.
That's insane.
Yeah.
Wow.
So they got that, managed to get that on the Game Boy ad, and then we changed the lyrics to Playing With The Boy.
Okay.
And so it fitted the Game Boy thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And it sampled all the Game Boy sounds.
Oh,
and
amazing.
Star Wars samples, you know, May the Force Be With You and all this in there. And we brought in the guy who took me to engineer, his dad was a famous actor.
Yeah.
He's been in loads of films, and he came in and reproduced all the samples for us.
Wow. So let's just, we're right at the beginning of the interview. We're like 14, 15 minutes in. You've told me, right, that you discovered rave music. You weren't engaging very well at school. You're going out to the hardcore clubs. The iconic ones of the early 90s. You've then got into a group of friends, found yourself in the famous gay clubs like Heaven and Trade, etc. You're also mixing with some of the DJs and getting to know one or two people there. At the same time as this, you've landed a sweet job in a recording studio where Kate Bush and others are passing through. And the first time you make a record, you end up on a Nintendo commercial. Like, this really does feel like this was meant to be, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it just sort of kind of all fitted into place, you know. And had I not got that job at the studio in London, I'd never met Toby. I'd never been introduced to the whole gay scene clubbing thing back in the days. And that's where the music that I make now originated. That's where it came from.
Yeah.
That's what was pioneered. So when I started to make that sort of music, I was only making music for 5 DJs to play, yeah, and out of 2 venues. And if they played them, I was happy, you know? So I would literally just make records for Tony DeVee, Eminem, Pete Waldman, Steve Thomas, all those DJs that were playing at trade and gay clubs. That's how I learned my, excuse the pun, but that's how I learned my trade.
Amazing. So when did it sort of, at what point did it sort of, because obviously, I mean, your story is insane. And despite me knowing you now for many years, I didn't know this until now, but when did it, you've gone straight in on a massive record. The first thing you ever, I mean, the first thing I ever made was Useless. It was recorded on a cassette. But
yeah, but I was being trained. I had the help of the Toby who was there, you know, and we were both engineers. So we knew I was becoming an engineer. Yeah. So I knew the technical aspects of putting it together and all that kind of stuff. And
yeah.
And it was a lucky link up. The fact that I was working at a company that dealt with music for TV ads, and then it all the stuff that music was massive at the time, and kind of all the stars aligned for that.
Yeah,
I mean, that led us, you know, then working at PWL's studio together, which didn't go anywhere. We made a couple of records down. We went to the Bunker,
right?
It was called the Bunker, PWL. Went down there, and I think I actually got kicked out of the Bunker for smoking a spliff. you know, 18 or however old I was, 19, in fact, doing that. And that didn't go anywhere. We made a couple of record things down there. And then I think the next thing we did is we wrote a record. It was the year Gina G was in the Eurovision Song Contest. So the other boss for this place that I worked, he was really into entering the Eurovision Song Contest every year and had done it for years, right, and really liked it. And, you know, he just, you know, that was his little thing on the side.
Yeah.
So we decided to write a dance music entry for Eurovision Song Contest not long after this cycle. And it got into the final 3 for the UK.
Wow.
So we lost to Gina G, basically, who then became the entry. But we got to go and do Top of the Pops with this. We were on Top of the Pops doing this.
So is there video footage out there of you doing it?
Video footage out there of you doing me doing it. Yeah. Actually, now if I look at the clothes I was wearing, they're bang, bang, back in fashion now.
You'd be at the pinnacle, at the heart of
be at the heart of fashion.
Wow.
But yeah, there's me in a pair of Oakleys miming on a Korg M1 to an organ bass line, you know.
What an experience. You know, I'm quite fortunate in recent times because I work, as you well know, with lots of kind of 90s pop stars, like Entrance and Technotronic, and they sort of share stories of their experiences. For example, a few weeks ago, I saw Tim from Utah Saints, and he's got obviously many, you probably know him, yeah. He's got many stories of Top of the Pops. What was that like, man? I mean, I never got to go. I would love to.
It was tiny. It was really small and tiny. You just don't realize how small it was, you know. But yeah, it was the BBC, and it was small and tiny and shockingly small when you get there.
Yeah,
you like think it's a big studio and stuff like that. You know, there's not a lot of people, and it was full of prepubescent teenage people, spotty teenage people dancing and saying woo when they were told to.
It just sounds amazing. Wow, that's amazing. So the music's kind of split in now, right? So it's, you know, hardcore's kind of gone in one way. You've got jungle and drum and bass and dark side and whatever you want to, you know, flip a coin at. You obviously had house is now also going in different directions. You've got the tech, the funk, you know, there's hard house is sort of emerging via the techno and a bit of a fusion of some of the hard, you know, like where did you position yourself at this point? Because obviously you're quite neatly amongst all of it. So,
yeah, I mean, I just followed what I was clubbing to, and the clubs that I went to, they progressed musically. So they were originally, even the gay clubs were originally playing sort of hardcore stuff, you know, when I first went there, but combined with stuff like your Age of Love, your kind of European, it was European techno, I guess, back in those days. And I just sort of moved with the sound, and that sound became, you know, there was other clubs like Sex at Café de Paris with DJs like Princess Julia and Rachel Auburn, and they were playing, you know, records like, do you remember Who's the Bad Man You Can Drop?
Yeah, of course.
Express 2 and
amazing. Stuff. I've got some of those records behind me, actually.
It progressed into all that kind of stuff. Say What, Express 2, Who's the Bad Man? And then that kind of became Hard Bag, and with DJs like Pete Warman. And I just was in that scene. So I just followed as the music progressed. I progressed musically with it, you know.
Yeah. That's insane. So you just sort of followed your heart and kind of went with it. Also, another question I sort of have now, obviously you're kind of immersed in the whole gay scene, and as a straight guy, how was that? Like, how did it just feel natural? Was that ever?
The whole point about that scene is you were going there, like, unlike, so at the time, a lot of, so, you know, I guess straight events or raves were in, not in so much in clubs. They were in venues. They were in warehouses, fields, blah, blah, blah. Whereas the gay scene was doing the club thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it was people that went there, but you went there for the music. You weren't there because you were out to try and pull someone or blah, blah, blah. You were there for the music. So it was kind of irrelevant.
It didn't matter. It was just unity. Because that's one of the whole things I loved about the rave scene is that it didn't matter who you are, what race you are, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You could just dance together. You'd meet loads of great friends from all walks of life. And I guess it's a similar vibe.
I said this before, like one thing that Trade, which is the original kind of hard house club, and it was the after hours gay club. It started at 4 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday and went on till 4 o'clock, 4 o'clock that afternoon, you know. A brilliant, absolutely amazing place. Still the best place I've ever DJed or been to all these years later. It doesn't take enough credit for developing inclusivity. It was inclusive before the word inclusive was a word.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. Yeah. You know, it's a buzzword now, isn't it? Everyone wants to be inclusive.
Yeah.
But you'd go down Trade and you'd have, you know, straight boy from East London, me, mm-hmm. who went to school in Essex, dancing next to a bank manager dressed in drag from, you know, everyone was down there and we were all there for the same reason. And those sort of clubs completely broke down barriers. And if you think, you know, to take that further, Tony DeVee, who's a gay DJ, has become an icon to hundreds of thousands of straight boys. Absolutely. across the world.
Yeah. Do you know, I get it. We were talking about this a little bit. I recently interviewed, I better not say his name because I don't know what order I'm going to release these in, but I was speaking to another guest like yourself recently, and we were talking about logistics and geography and all that kind of stuff, and how unfortunately over time people can base their opinion on, say, a genre of music or an MC or whatever, based on where they come from in the UK. So they might say, oh, this is a northern DJ or this is a southern sound, or which I get it to a degree of kind of wanting to put it into a conversation and putting a label on it, but I don't get it if you're going to disregard it because of that, the opening sentence. So for me, for example, growing up, some of my friends, a little pocket of them liked really industrial gabber music. It didn't fit well with my palate, if I'm honest. I preferred break beats and, you know, happy hardcore and hip hop and whatever. But nonetheless, if I disregarded it, I'm not going to find anything that I like based on the fact that they're going to say they're going to listen to Gabberin. And I kind of get what you're saying there, because like the whole geography thing, it's sort of, it's about keeping it open-minded, and you don't sort of base it on a particular area, clientele, race, you know, whatever that might be. I think you should always just sort of accept it for what it is, you know?
Yeah, it was everyone from every walk of generation there for the same purpose, to dance to great music by their favorite DJs.
Yeah.
And just by that, as cheesy as it sounds, it just goes how to show you how music can break down barriers.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. I don't want to turn this too much into something that's painful for you to talk about. It's the last thing I want to do. But obviously, Tony did become a great friend of yours. It's only,
a million people that say, oh, I knew Tony through being at trade and dropping records down. Wasn't he was not even a colleague. It's hard to explain, but I wasn't one of it. I was very good friends with that whole group.
Yeah.
But I don't want to sit here and go, yeah, Tony DeVee was my...
I agree. I mean, because...
I knew him through me going to trade and me printing up acetates back in those days, dub plates, and I used to leave them in the DJ booths. And this is where Tony DeVee, but also E&M and Steve Thomas, who, you know, all those trade DJs who sometimes get overlooked because of the whole Tony thing.
Yeah.
All those guys were exceptionally helpful to me in the fact that I would print up an acetate, I'd drop it down to them, and rather than go, oh yeah, great, a lot of them would go, yeah, it's okay. You know what's wrong? Your kick drum's wrong and your thing's wrong, and it's a bit too long here and short there. They would actually give me, you know, Tony included, give me advice back.
Yeah.
And I would start to listen to their advice, you know, and start changing my productions and blah, blah, blah. And you'd often take them down, and every now and again you'd hear one played. And it eventually got to the point where I put an acetate in the couple of acetates in the trade booth. They'd nick each other's acetates, fight over it, and you'd hear it played straight away without them even taking it home. So
amazing.
We went from not getting any stuff to play to hearing 15, 16 tracks of mine played within the night, each DJ playing two or three things, you know.
Phenomenal. Well, I'm mindful as well that you, even now, all these years later, you still pay homage to Tony. And regardless of what the relationship was like, you're a big part of keeping his legacy alive because of the work you do and the stuff that you do. But
that whole trade sound, I would not have a job, or I wouldn't be doing what I was doing, if it wasn't for Tony DeVee, E&M, Pete Waldman, Steve Thomas, and also Lawrence Malice, who was the promoter of trade, who did something very, very unique then. And you kind of take it for standard now, right? You almost take it for standard. He created a lineup that told a story and a journey. So you'd often go to clubs, and especially in the rave scene, you'd have Colin Dale, followed by Carl Cox, then someone else. They were all individual sets.
Yeah.
We're all individual sets in the night. But what they did there was they created, you know, starting off with Malcolm Duffy playing US House, into Alan Thompson, who plays tougher US and tribal. And it would pick up into Steve Thomas, who'd play the triply tracks, slower hard house, chunky, tough hard house, into Tony, who'd play the tough hard house into a bit of techno, and then into a bit of the European hard house, then into E&M, who'd just nail the arse out of it with the hardest European, you know. And this, by this time, it's, you know, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock in the morning, the next afternoon. And finished up by either Tony. Originally it was Tall Paul, but my favourite, like my kind of real clubbing lineup was finished with Pete Waldman, who'd bring it back round to being a bit bouncy and happy. Just when you thought, "Fuck me, I can't take any more of this," boom! On Pete Waldman would come with a bit of bounce and happiness, and the place would go absolutely ballistic again. So, you know what they created there was that first thing of DJs in a specific order, in a specific set, and you were booked to play a specific time with the, your sound fitted. Unlike now, where you go, oh, I can't do one till two because I've got another gig, I'll have to play da-da-da-da-da. No, this is where you were playing, you're playing that time or you don't play. And it was one of the hardest places to get a gig there. I was very lucky to become a resident there eventually.
Well, it was well deserved. So yeah, big shout to Trade. Amazing.
Yeah, no, they did a, you know, a lot of good work for Hard House. That doesn't, even with Hard House is having a bit of a resurgence at the moment, and you watch young kids, 20-year-old, 25-year-old kids, 20-year-old kids, whatever they are, playing some of those old Trade records, and I know they don't know the history of it and where it came from, you know.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, you've just said the buzzword Hard House. Obviously, yeah. As I said in the intro, right, you're part of the heartbeat of that music. Now, I'm not saying that you are the be-all and end of it, that there's a collection of people, much like there is in any genre, you know, but nonetheless, you're one of the major arteries within that genre. Was there ever a moment, and we'll talk a bit more about Hard House in a second, but was there ever a moment where you just sort of looked at what you had created and you were looking at thousands of people on the dance floor every weekend and multiple shows all over the world, did you ever sort of stand there and think, look what I've done, man? Look at the, like, was there that sort of moment where you sort of thought, rah?
I hate to keep going banging back to Trade, but my ever first moment that I thought I'd made it was when two things. Tony DeVee played one of my records, you know, a few of my records at Trade, and the place went off. Then I listened to the radio and heard him playing the same record at Love Parade in Leeds, which is a massive thing. And then I was driving down. It was like 2 o'clock on a Wednesday afternoon, and I'm driving round London in the car. Kiss FM was what everyone used to listen to back in the day.
Yeah,
Kiss FM's playing, and all of a sudden my track comes on at 2 o'clock, Radio One. And what had happened is they get a specialist DJ on to pick a track that's going to go onto the playlist of the weekly normal playlist. A specialist DJ picks a track that's going to go onto the weekly playlist.
Yeah.
And Tony B had picked my track on a Saturday, and it was being played every day on Kiss that week. And that's when I thought, fucking hell, yeah, this is going all right.
Gassed, man. That's amazing. And was there any sort of moments like where you've sort of, well, I know they, because I'm speaking from personal experience, there's moments and there's little sort of flowers that appear in your career, and some of them are right at the beginning, some of them are halfway through, some of them happen randomly the other day type thing. So I get that the flowers always appear when you're least expecting them to, but was there sort of like, you know, obviously you were touring Australia, you're going to Germany, you're going all over the place, man. I mean, Hard House was blowing up. And with that, you obviously, I know that famous actors like Nick Frost and other people are obviously latching onto the music and following you. I mean, talk to me about that, man. It must have been nuts.
It was, I mean, it was crazy. So even if they were in the UK, I was probably doing 5 to 6 gigs a weekend. So I would, so most of it, it's a lot of it. And you look back now and think, God, I wish I'd have saved all my passes, and I wish I'd have saved my wristbands and all of that. But at the time, it was such a whirlwind just to hold it all together.
Yeah.
You know, doing 5-6 gigs at a weekend, and then you having to produce in the week as well. You got a remix to do for Ministry, or you got, you know, Dave Pierce, I was doing some remixes for, and what was his, like, Data Life or Data, whatever that was back in the days.
Yeah.
So you had working. So at the time, it was a whirlwind to hold it together. I'd literally leave my house on a Friday night at 8 o'clock and get back at 8 o'clock on a Monday morning sometimes. And having been in loads of clubs, a hotel, and whatever, or I'd, you know, flown to Canada and back.
Yeah.
Done one gig in Vancouver, one in Edmonton, and then flown home.
Yeah.
So it was just a whirlwind at the time. So you just caught up in it so much that you don't have that time to actually step back and go, whoa, what's going on here?
Yeah.
You're just so busy organizing it and doing it that you don't realize until after that you go, fucking hell, how did I do that? You know, I've been to New Zealand for New Year's Eve for one night, for one gig.
Amazing. You know. Amazing. And was there any sort of times where you've met someone famous or whatever and you've kind of gone, shit, it's so-and-so, you know, like, was there, do you have any moments? Because I had a couple. I'll give you an example. Gamma and I played in LA, I suppose it's probably 2008, 2009, 2010, or somewhere around them. And Woody Harrelson came out to watch us. And he was absolutely, well, I better not say in case I get sued, but he was having a good time, shall we say. But nonetheless, that was like, rah, that's mad. Equally, I met Tiny Lister, who was Debo from Friday. I got to sit at the table with him and have some food and everything, which was nuts because I'd watched it. Was there moments like that where you saw, because obviously, I mean, Hard House arguably was bigger than hardcore at this point. I mean, it was ginormous.
It was massive, and yes, you'd see faces, you know, especially in some of the places, some of the gay clubs, you'd see the guys from the Pet Shop Boys, you'd see Boy George out and about.
Wow.
All those, you know, all those kind of people. But the trouble is, you were in and out a lot of the time then. When it was at its peak, I would get there 15 minutes before, play your set, and then you'd have to go straight away to make your next gig. So the actual socializing and the mingling wasn't so much on the cards back then, you know? And it's only like you speak about people like Nick Frost who went harder. At that time, he wasn't Nick Frost.
I suppose he was still Frost, a raver sort of thing.
Yeah. He would have just been a club or a raver who was out and about. Not just, but, you know,
I know what you mean.
He hadn't developed into his career that he developed into. So, but there would have been loads of people like that out and about raving in those days. But that's the real beauty of the hard house scene and probably the hardcore scene as well, is it wasn't about famous people. No one gave a fuck. Yeah. It was about going out with a group of mates, dancing to the best, most upfront music possible.
Yeah.
Having a great time. And you didn't care who you were. You didn't care. You'd meet who you were dancing to, but you wouldn't be like, oh my God, there's It wasn't that, you know, people weren't trying to be glitzy and glam and that. They were trying to rave and have a good time.
I love that. Revolution.
Yes.
Obviously.
Still going 22 years, 23 years later.
We need to talk about it. I hate to talk about it because I know it's an obvious question. I know it is. But, you know, that is one of your many calling cards. I read some facts on you as well. And between 95 and 2005, apparently, you wrote over 100 and wrote and released over 100 records. That's nuts. But, let's talk about Revolution.
Those records would have had three tracks on as well.
That's absolutely, you were just a machine, but by the sounds of things, you were making bangers since day one. But let's talk about Revolution. Obviously, it's, for those that don't know, it's a huge hard dance anthem. It's recently, over the past 4 or 5 years, had a sort of come back into flavour with really famous sort of obsolete techno DJs round to big, you know, main room DJs dropping it. And as Ben's just, it's over 20 years old. I mean, when you were making it, was there a moment when you sat there and sort of went, "Ah, oh, this is a banger," like, or was it just like all the other millions of records you've made?
I was working. I was doing the label called Nucleus at the time, and I'd gone from making TV and film music, and I'd started working as an engineer for Nucleus, and I was doing stuff on the side. There was a label called Media Records. It wasn't Nucleus at the time. It's called Media Records and UMM, and they were doing house stuff and all other bits and stuff. And I was going to trade, and I was doing stuff on the side. And I think the stuff I was doing on the side was doing just as well, if not better, than the stuff I was engineering for as a day job. And that's when they said, all right, let's bring that into what we're doing there. And we started to make the Hard Beat EPs. And at the time, I was engineering there for Stu Allen.
Wow.
You know, doing the clock stuff and some of the Visa stuff for Stu Allen.
He
was a massive sort of hardcore DJ, a massive influence on the whole dance music scene, especially up the north of England. Yeah, you can't mention his name without anyone that's into dance music was probably introduced to it by Stu Allen's radio.
Well, do you know, when obviously I was fortunate to work with him on several occasions throughout my career, and even back to being a raver at school and listening to cassettes of him at Amnesia House and whatnot. But when he passed, my mum, who is now 77, heard that he had passed and mentioned it to me. So even my mum, so that's the generational thing that Stu had. It was, you know.
Just massive. In fact, he taught me loads on how you should arrange a track so you can mix it in properly. This is where I learned. This is why I got better at what I was doing, because I was engineering for Stu, and he'd be like, right, 32 bars before the bass comes in. I learned all of that, a lot of that from Stu.
Amazing.
Sitting in the studio with Stu, you know, a lot of stuff I learned from that. And I developed this sound there, this hard beat sound, which was my kind of sound with this very knocky kick drum and offbeat bass and rave and Hoover samples and And that sound had got massive and got really big. And consequently, because of that sound got so big, everyone started to sort of make that sound.
Yeah.
So when I very first started making that sound, everyone was playing hard trance. So when they played one of my records with this knocky kick and offbeat bass line and almost quite monotone, it would sound completely different. And that's why it would get a response.
Yeah.
The kick comes slamming in. So what I did is when everyone started to copy me and sample my kick drums and sample that kind of sound became the norm.
Yeah.
For hard house, I thought, well, why don't I do the opposite again? I'll make something a bit more musical with a softer, rounder, fatter kick drum, and but he'll be able to play it in hard house sets. So it was a conscious thing to go, you know what? I think I'll just make something, you know, something that's the opposite to what everyone else is doing. And I suppose it was a bit of a gamble at the time, but I needed something for my DJ sets which was a bit euphoric. It gave you that euphoric moment. I kind of identified that, yes, you can have your screw face moments and head down and blah, 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 but you need those hands in the air, euphoric.
Absolutely.
I call them MDMA moments, those bits that you know, send people off the edge and add a little bit of emotion and thing like that. And so that's why I did Revolution. That's why I tried to make something a bit more musical with Revolution, and that was combined with the time of wanting to sound too geeky before I was making all my music on a machine called an MPC-60, which was a dedicated standalone sequencer drum machine.
Well, they use it a lot in hip-hop, don't they? Dr. Dre, etc.
It was the first, I think one of the first or second tracks I'd actually made when I moved onto a computer, onto a Mac, and started to use Logic. And it was, that's, you know, it was the first, so I was finding my way about, but sometimes new is fresh as well.
Exciting.
New thing allows you to work in a different way and do new things, like the riff, the famous sort of riff sound from Revolution came from a outboard virus synth that I had. But then I put it into the computer, and there was a program at the time called Recycle, which allowed you to chop it up and move it around. And I made it more staccato.
Yeah.
And then that went into the sampler, and I could add portamento to it, and I could have a bit more control over it. And that's how that vibe and that sound was made, you know? So it was a bit of a thing of moving over to new equipment, as well as I trying to move and do something different from the other hard beats, because a lot of those hard beats are essentially, you know, that was my sound, but they're kind of the same record.
Yeah.
I get it. My sound, it was a thing, but they're the same idea. They're the same ethos behind each record. So I was trying to do something different. And I remember, I think the very first time I ever played it out was in Hereford at a club called Naughty But Nice.
Okay.
I think it was there or Storm. There or Storm was the very first time.
That was
time
a big one over in Leicestershire, wasn't it, Storm?
I think it was maybe Naughty But Nice, and then I tried it out again at Storm for like the second time or whatever. And I put it on at Naughty But Nice, and usually when you play a record that no one's ever played before, I put it on and the place went absolutely batshit crazy. And I was like, oh. All the DJs were like, what's this? What's this? What's this?
Yeah.
You know, everyone got where it kicked in. Everyone cheered at the right points. Everyone, when the bass line dropped for the first time, because it was a rolling bass line from the offbeat bass line, all that. I was like, oh, wow, okay. That's all right. That's okay. That seems to go all right. And then I just remember playing it again for probably at Storm and then maybe at Crash. There was a club I used to play in London regularly called Crash called Convergence. Then playing it out there. And every time I put it on, it would be like, wow.
Yeah.
This is going down really well. I mean, you know, I'd already had records like Music Is Moving and Badass and all that like that.
Yeah, we can't sleep on that. I mean, Music Is Moving is ginormous. I think it's been sampled to absolute death, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it was just sampling in the first place. But it was it was like loads of, I'd had big records, if you know what I mean. Yeah. But there was something a little bit different about when you played this one.
Yeah.
But what happened with that record is because I'd made the kick softer, because it was a little bit more trancey, it leaked out. It came out of the hard house scene. It would become the last record in a big trance DJ set.
Yeah.
You know, they could then play it.
Yeah. And they just add a bit more energy, I suppose. Yeah. Brilliant.
Right. I don't know, Breaks DJ started to play it as well. It just, we had this weird thing where, okay, I was at a Breaks party and the big Breaks DJ played it. And then someone, I think it was Anne Savage or someone, sent me a video of it being dropped at Space in Ibiza.
Amazing.
In the middle of a house set by one of the massive house DJs. David Morales or Roger Sand, someone you just wouldn't expect to play.
Yeah.
Okay, this is weird. And obviously Judge Jules and Dave Pierce were hammering it on Radio 1.
Yeah.
And then it went to A-list Radio 1. It went to the daytime playlist on Radio 1. But it went to daytime playlist Radio 1 at near Christmas time for its, when they re-released it.
Yeah.
So there was a bit of a problem with Woolworths at the time.
Right.
And ABC, they were making space for Elvis's greatest hits, Ready for Christmas.
Right, okay.
So it was a top 40 record, but it actually, I think, sold more than that was at number 10 in the Christmas charts. It would have been a top 10 record at Christmas.
Can you imagine?
But 80% of it was sold through specialist chart shops. And in fact, it's the last vinyl, because they didn't bother to, they didn't do CDs because HMV wouldn't take them.
Yeah.
Or Woolworths wouldn't take them because it was Christmas. So they were like, no, we're not going to take CDs. So they didn't print up any CDs, Nucleus, which is, you know, a bit of a silly thing, but they didn't. So it was vinyl, but it transpired that it was the last vinyl only top 40 ever.
Wow.
So
it's
the story is just released on vinyl to enter the only vinyl only top 40, last ever vinyl only top 40.
That's just mental. I mean, some of the, because obviously I follow you on social media and I see you resharing these sort of cool, trendy DJs from every country in the world, I should point out. We're not just talking about America or UK. These young girls and guys are from everywhere, every continent. And they're playing a record that is essentially, in some cases, older than they are. I mean, how does that feel to know that you've sort of... I mean, it's a bit like being a pop star from back in the day and the song still gets spun. You know, like Mariah Carey's Christmas song comes out every year. It's still smashing it. It must be nuts.
Well, it started to get a resurgence, like you say, maybe 3-4 years ago, where techno DJs were doing a thing... And the DJs, there was a bit of a trend to play an out-the-box record in your set.
Yeah.
So they'd play their normal stuff, and then they'd play an out-the-box record, which would blow up on social media, and everyone would go, wow, oh my God, I can't believe he played that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? Reason, everyone just picked Revolution. And, you know, Charlotte DeWitt played it, Amelie Lenz.
Alan Fitzpatrick was banging it, wasn't he, for a bit?
Everyone dropped this record. I've even got a clip of Adam Bayer playing it at Print Rooms.
Wow.
Works in London. They all started playing the record. It got a load of hype again, and I was speaking to Alan Fitzpatrick at the time, and we did a new version of it that was released on his We Are the Brave, and we kind of got the who's who of everyone to do a remix. Rainer Zonneveld did a remix, and loads. It was a big sort of remix package, and I did a new version. A lot of people played Rainer's, but a lot of people played the new version that I did as well.
Yeah.
So for me, being among the new breed, but then still having the version that was played by everyone else was a good move, if you know what I mean. So
yeah, it was a gift.
Like Anna and everyone was playing it again. And I thought, yeah, that's great. It's going to have that. It's going to peak. But that was 2 years ago now, and I'm still tagged 15, 20 times a day with people playing the record at massive festivals.
Yeah, well, I remember, so for context, Ben and I often work on educational programs for the Lisa Lash's School of Music, and I remember Ben being stood in the basement at one of the venues before COVID hit. So how many years ago was that? 3-4 years ago? And you'd been tagged to some video of this ginormous festival and it was being dropped there. So I think you're doing yourself a disservice. This song's been banging it for 4 or 5 years, I reckon.
Yeah, again, yeah, it just doesn't seem to stop. It just seems to stop, but the DJs just get younger that are playing it. It's just become a bit of a hard music sort of anthem, really.
I love that. Well, listen, if you are dipping into this podcast from happy hardcore or jungle, drum and bass, hip hop, TV, whatever reason you have found yourself listening to this interview, jump on your Spotify, jump on your YouTube and check it out. Absolute banger. And now you can kind of talk to your friends about the backstory. Amazing. I find it utterly fantastic. But I can't as well. Another thing I want to touch upon is something that people often might sleep on when it comes to you, Ben, is the fact that you've worked with countless commercial artists. So you've done stuff with Lethal Bizzle. I remember you telling me stories of hip hop artists in America. Talk a little bit about that, if you don't mind.
It's from working in a different studio. I did a backing track for Lethal Bizzle. I lose track of all this stuff, if I'm really honest.
It's mental.
But yeah, I did commercial stuff, pop stuff, and also I do a lot of house music on Tool Room as well, under the guys Tough London, with a production partner Sam Townend. Do stuff like that for those guys. Work with Mark Knight, artists like that on Tool Room.
Was it Todd Terry that you did some?
Todd Terry, yeah, I did a collab with Todd Terry as Tough London as well. So yeah, there's a list of sort of big artists in different genres that I've done stuff with. And you know, I was doing a lot of the Tough London stuff a few years ago. I'm still doing it now, but the hard stuff has just come back round for me.
Yeah,
quite a lot. And it's, you know, it's my original sound, and I'm noticing like the gigs are changing again. So they're going from club shows, and I've got the festivals are coming back in and stuff like that. It goes in cycles, doesn't it?
Yeah, totally. Well, thanks for talking about it. I've got a couple more things that I want to go to, and then I'll let you get on with your day, because I'm mindful of time and we're sort of at the 50 odd minute mark. So I don't want to keep you much longer, and I really do appreciate it. So the first thing is, before I get onto my silly questions, and of course there's always going to be silly questions because it's me, but first of all, you've talked a little bit about Tough London, you've talked about how busy you are. Obviously you mentioned at the beginning of this interview that you're working on a 5-track EP. What happens tomorrow? So a lot of what we've talked about is reflecting and looking on what's already happened. What's next for you? Like, where are you going? What's your plans?
I have pretty much just in the middle of this month, sorting out the whole year's release schedules. So I've got a lot of stuff, some stuff coming out on Armada. I work with Armada quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
I was up there. I've just been up there recently over to Amsterdam to sort some stuff with those guys. And I have a release that actually, I believe that you're on.
Oh,
yeah. Which it hasn't been announced what label it is coming on yet, so can't say that yet. But that's scheduled in for a few months, 2 or 3 months' time. I'm not sure. They're just working on the release schedule now. It's a track that I worked on for a massive, massive DJ who's absolutely smashing it at the minute, and it's been signed to their label. And I'd originally used a bit of a sample, and you wrote an original rap.
Put a new spin on it, I suppose you could call it that. Yeah, Ben very kindly approached me and asked me if I'd be interested. I should point out, for those of you that listen to me for my raps and things like that, you're probably not going to even know it's me when you hear it. If you hear it on the radio or in a set, you might not even identify, but it was a really fun project.
Yeah, so that's coming out, and I'm just working on doing some more bits for them, hopefully. So I should have about at least 4 or 5 things lined up release-wise for this year. And then just looking at the populating the diary with gig stuff at the moment, which is going really well. Got some festival stuff in there, quite a bit of abroad stuff. At least 4 or 5 countries have gone in so far this year. So that's building up. I'm really lucky that I'm at a stage in my life and my career where I start to pick the gigs that I want to do. And I don't mean that as, I don't want to sound like spoiled or...
I totally understand. Yeah, I'm sure the listeners do as well.
But just like, I want to pick the ones that I'm going to enjoy doing, you know, and either take me to a new audience or things, you know, I enjoy being in the studio so much, and I've got so much going on in the studio that to take me away from that to do the live gigs, which I absolutely love. And I'm to say, I'm probably enjoying DJing more now in the last year than I probably did during the whole of my career, because I'm so kind of relaxed and enjoying it now.
Yeah.
And you're kind of in a place where you've got nothing to prove.
Yeah, just having
you're
fun.
Not practicing around to make a living, da 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 da.
Yeah.
I'm enjoying it more, and I'm probably more creative and having more fun with my DJing now than I ever did. So that's the next step is I'm just gonna concentrate on doing the ones that I wanna do.
Amazing. Well, ladies and gentlemen, make sure that you check out and support Ben with his forthcoming releases. You've already heard that since the first record he ever made, he's been making bangers. And also, I wouldn't be sat here talking to him if his songs were rubbish. He's absolutely phenomenal and one of the most talented people in my phone book. So please make sure that you check out all of his stuff. Also, you can check Ben out live at several different shows, including Tidy. I mean, the list continues. We're also playing together in Corfu for Unity in the Sun for our mutual friend Billy Bunter. So get yourselves out there. Make sure you're supporting everything that BK does in his various guises. Now we get onto the silliness. This is right. Okay, so I've got two last sections before I let you go. And this first one is, it's not a quick fire, but nonetheless, I'm going to ask you a question, and I don't want you to overthink it, but nonetheless, you know, I don't want you to, you know, not give it some consideration. Does that make sense?
Right. Yeah.
Okay. So you've been at a gig, you've been on the motorway, right? You've pulled into the petrol station and you're inside, you've put the petrol in or whatever you've got to do. And now you're in there. And as you're walking towards the till, you are greeted by all of the confectionery. And what I mean is the chocolate bars, the sweets. Yeah. What are you reaching for?
Jelly tots.
Jelly tots.
I think about it.
Amazing.
Jelly tots are my go-to car thing. Always be sit in the car, have some jelly tots.
I absolutely love that. So you've grabbed your jelly tots and you've turned around, and now you're looking at the drinks, and you need a drink to accompany it. Obviously, there's Pepsi and Sprite, and the list continues. What are you getting?
Coke Zero.
Coke Zero. Always Coke Zero? Just the go-to?
It used to be Diet Coke. Diet Coke's really addictive. I think it's more addictive than Coke Zero.
Do you know?
Just a Coke Zero, I think.
Yeah, nicely done. Okay. Well, it's come to later on in the journey. You're driving along, and it's got to about the point where... you know, you can't be bothered to cook. You know, it's just been one of those weekends. You're feeling a bit drained. You've done a few shows. You've had some junk food to keep you going through. The only thing that's left open is chain restaurants.
Right.
So the Chinese is unfortunately a shut. The Indian restaurants. So there's
so KFCs.
Yeah, you get the idea. Which one are you going for?
Oh, gee, it's a hard question to answer that one because it all depends on the time and the moment.
Yeah, I know it's a hard one, but I'm going to have to push you.
It's probably got to be McD's, isn't it?
Yeah, you're going for a Macca's.
On the you can't go wrong with a McD's on the motorway. A McD's or, yeah, I should imagine. Although, yeah, it would be a McD's, definitely.
McDonald's, ladies and gentlemen.
If we're talking fast food, kind of just motorway fast food, It would have to be. But I'd regret doing it as soon as I'd had the last mouthful.
Yeah.
Like, I shouldn't have eaten that.
Yeah, you're feeling pure and need a shower.
And then you feel hungry like an hour again later.
Yeah, 30 seconds after you finished it. No, absolutely.
I would, you know, it sounds so bad, but I would probably rather stop off at M&S.
Yeah.
On Waitrose. Yeah. On the way. It sounds very, very middle class.
Yeah, I know.
But, you know.
You'd never guess you're a white guy after you said that. But anyway, right, for our last section, the last piece of the puzzle is, I'm going to play my little ident right now.
Oh, yes, this is highly recommended.
So, what I need from you, and this is going to be quite tricky, but I can edit it down if you need time to think, is the first one. I need a highly recommended by... It doesn't have to be DJ Cool. This can be a personal recommendation from your regular, you know, chilling with your missus or type vibe. But I need a film. What film should they go and check out?
I couldn't. Do you know what? Just because it's just been Christmas, I'm going to say The Muppets Christmas Carol.
Oh, what a banger.
Because it's been Christmas. Recently, we're recording this in January, whatever time this goes out. But yeah. That was something that was just reminded to me lately that was such a banger of a film.
It absolutely was, man. Muppets are slept on, you know. Okay, TV show. Is there a TV show that you enjoy?
Loads of TV shows that I enjoy. I do like watching the series. I'll just say what I'm watching at the moment. Cool. I'm watching Glitch at the moment.
Ooh, I've not heard of that. What's that?
So it's about a small Australian town and some of the people in the town come back to life all of a sudden. Not like zombies.
Yeah.
They just come back to life. So you can imagine someone's come back to life. This guy's wife's come back to life and he comes back and he's remarried with kids to her best friend. But his dead wife's just turned up.
Oh, okay. Hey, what's this? Is this on Netflix or is it on iPlayer? Or?
Netflix. It's just what I'm watching at the moment. There's too many good series I could go on about.
It sounds like a good one. I might check
Star Wars series is on Star Wars series on Disney are all bangers.
In my eldest watched The Mandalorian and he loved that.
Banger.
Yeah, banger. I bet he went. I'll
be a bit of Star Wars.
Right, okay. I got two more and then you are free. Book. Do you read many books? Any books that you'd recommend?
Rob Tazera's book at the moment, if I'm very honest.
Yeah.
And there's a little picture of me in there. And the last two books I've read are Rob Tazera's and Mr. Billy Daniel Bunter's book.
Yeah, I'm mentioned in that one. Yeah, so look at us with our little cameos in books. You can get both of those books, incidentally, at musicmondays.com. And finally, the final question that I'm going to ask before I let you go and relax is album. And it doesn't have to be rave music. In fact, you could give a rave one and a non-rave one.
Guilty Generation.
Of course.
And Queen, there's something about Queen probably.
Queen, okay, excellent.
The one that was, It's a Kind of Magic. I've forgotten the name of the album now, but all that kind of era.
I love that. Well, ladies and gentlemen, there was...
Oh yes, this is highly recommended.
By the legend, the icon, the musical god that from his very first record was making absolute fire. When you go look in an encyclopedia and you look at cavemen rubbing sticks together to make warmth, this guy came naturally if only they had had a BK around. Ben, thank you so much, mate. It means so much for you to give up your time for this. Thank you, bro.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Big up. If you enjoyed what you heard here today, then please like, comment and subscribe. Also, if you have any comments, suggestions or anything else, ping us an email on thepodnoodle@wzkd.co.uk.